Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Donna Stair.
And I'm her husband, Alan. This is a week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch. We're getting into the music,
the trivia,
and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, don't touch that dial. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to another WKRP cast. We're getting a little distracted today. Donna, what is our episode?
We are discussing Daydreams. The air date was the 24th of January, 1981. Written by P.J. Tarakvi as Peter Tarakvi. Story editor, Lisa Levin. Executive story consultants, Steve Marshall and Dan Gunselman. Directed by Rod Daniel. Mr. Carlson must give a speech at a broadcaster's dinner, so he rehearses his speech at work in front of the WKRP staff. It is so boring that everyone begins to daydream. They each daydream about what they would rather be doing than working at the station.
This episode falls in the category of a dream sequence or fantasy episode. Ever since sitcoms stopped airing live, writers and performers have always loved a good dream sequence story. Flashbacks, flash forwards, and alternate realities all fall in this category. I Love Lucy did one all the way back in 1953. Gilligan's Island had as many as 16 different episodes, which included dream sequences. Staying on the island got boring. Taxi gave us a look at Reverend Jim before the drugs. Friends did a full hour devoted to what-if scenarios, which included Phoebe as a stockbroker and Courtney Cox in a fat suit. Will and Grace even did a fantasy episode where they appeared as the cast of I Love Lucy. The fantasy episode allows performers to add to their character or play against type. In a dream sequence, Gilligan gets to be smart, or Phoebe gets to be savvy and aggressive.
Fantasy episodes may be fun for the writers and the performers, but they tend to be extra work for everyone else. Dream sequences often mean entirely new sets, different costuming, new lighting, sometimes even new makeup. As is the case with most fantasy episodes, this one was shot without a studio audience. WKRP also seems to have taken a little downtime before getting into this very complex episode. The two episodes shot right before this one were Baby, It's Cold Inside and The Painting. Both of those were done entirely on standard station sets with no special effects.
Let's get into the episode. We start out in Art's office where Art is pacing back and forth as he's having a discussion with Andy. Andy's telling him he's being ridiculous. He's not being the real Arthur Carlson.
Born leader, good sportsman, the epitome of style, grace.
Come on, that doesn't describe me.
No, it doesn't.
Andy tells him to let him explain why he said that. Art tells Andy he's trying to talk him into doing something he doesn't want to do.
Now that hurts, Mr. Carlson. That really hurts.
I'm sorry, Andy. I'm under stress.
Andy tells Art the way to alleviate that stress is to go out tonight and give that speech.
Well, Mr. Carlson tells Andy he's a little frightened.
Don't you realize the number one fear of all Americans is the fear of speaking in front of a large group of people?
Yeah. Andy says he read that. Carlson adds the fear of death came in third. Andy tells Carlson the broadcaster's dinner is not a big group.
No, but they can be mean. This is a boring speech. I know it is, Andy. Still, don't.
Andy calls Jennifer into the office. She gladly comes in and asks how she can help.
Andy explains to her Carlson is frightened.
Yes.
He tells her he has a speech tonight.
You know, he's been looking forward to this for weeks now, and he's chickening out.
Well, Jennifer seems to have the solution right out of her back pocket there.
Fear comes from not knowing what will happen. If you rehearse your speech in front of people you know, you'll find out what happens.
Turning to Andy, Jennifer finishes up.
Once he realizes that people are interested in what he has to say, he'll feel much better.
Yeah, they didn't rehearse that at all, did they?
Andy suggests he give the speech for the staff this afternoon. Jennifer agrees it's a wonderful idea. Mr. Carlson walks over to Andy and Jennifer.
Now, wait a minute, Jennifer. Did Andy get you to say that?
Mr. Carlson, Nobody ever gets me to do anything.
Jennifer's eyes, they open wide on the word gets for emphasis. Andy asks Mr. Carlson what he thinks. Well, Carlson begrudgingly agrees. Andy asks Jennifer to get everyone together in the bullpen. Before leaving, Jennifer has one more piece of advice.
Another good trick for conquering fear is to imagine your audience is completely naked.
Jennifer leaves the office.
Now, that would be the racier 80s version of the public speaking trick. I remember on the Brady Bunch, it was picturing your audience in their underwear.
Well, of course, yeah. On the Brady Bunch.
So Mr. Carlson picks up some cards from his desk.
Got my 3x5 cards.
He begins to walk out, then stops and looks at Andy, eyeing him up and down. Or chuckles.
Now, wait a minute. Will you just go? I promise.
Andy crosses his hands in front of his crotch, looking at Carlson.
And remember, that was also Andy's move with the beach ball during Filthy Pictures. He's always thinking about protecting the family jewels.
It's instinctive. Just boom, he goes right to that protective move. So Art quickly leaves his office.
So what are the top fears of Americans? Good question, and nobody seems to have the same answer. We may have spent more time on this one than we should have, but it was interesting. Fear of public speaking, or glossophobia, is a big fear with a lot of people. But in the age of COVID, our fears have changed. At the time of this episode, Art might be quoting Jerry Seinfeld, who had this now famous bit.
I saw a thing, actually, a study that said speaking in front of a crowd is considered the number one fear of the average person. I found that amazing. Number two was death. Death is number two? This means to the average person, if you have to be at a funeral, you would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy.
Funny stuff. But Jerry doesn't quote sources for his survey.
In several studies, public speaking outranked heights, bugs, snakes, clowns, zombies, needles, and claustrophobia. The percentage of folks who feared giving a speech ranged from as little as 7% to as high as 75% of the population. We noticed the fear of death wasn't even on several lists of top fears. According to a psychiatrist in a Psychology Today article, it's because fear of death always wins. No matter what you're afraid of, heights, strangers, zombies, clowns, you're really afraid of any of those things killing you. Sorry, Art and Jerry, but death is always our biggest fear, at least according to Psychology Today.
Chapman University conducted a survey of American fears for 2020-2021. These days, corrupt government officials rank as our number one fear. Behind that, in the age of COVID, we fear people we love dying or loved ones contracting the coronavirus, civil unrest, a pandemic, and cyber terrorism. Fear of public speaking was on the Chapman list, but it only ranked number 54 out of 95 listed fears. Maybe it's because we don't gather in groups so much anymore.
So as Art heads for the bullpen, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
The staff is all gathered in the bullpen as Andy introduces Mr. Carlson.
Tonight, Mr. Carlson has the honor of delivering the keynote address at the annual Ohio Broadcasters Dinner.
Johnny is less than enthused.
Oh, God.
And he explains he's asked Art to preview his little talk for them.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye NewsHawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Right middle finger.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist Les Nessman.
Ladies and gentlemen, the incredible Art Carlson.
And he claps his hands, encouraging the others to join in.
Mr. Carlson begins by thanking everyone. Jennifer enters the bullpen. She walks up to Mr. Carlson.
Remember what I said.
Mr. Carlson looks at his cards, raises his head to begin, sees Les sitting at his desk, and he starts chuckling. Poor Les. Yes. He looks around. He's confused. Andy gets Mr. Carlson back on track.
Mr. Carlson, the speech.
Oh, yes. Excuse me.
Andy is making the continue on motion with his hand.
So Art begins.
Radio. What is it? Where did it come from? And where is it going?
Oh, no.
We see Herb with a frightened expression on his face. He turns to look around at the others. Art continues.
Who would have thought that back in 1920, when station KDKA in Pittsburgh was granted the first commercial license, the radio would have become what it has? If any of you here can remember back to those times, you're probably quite old, so I'll speak up if you want me to.
KDKA is considered the first commercial radio station to have a license from the U.S. government. Although it had been on the air for a few months, the license took effect November 2nd of 1920. The first big news carried on KDKA, the 1920 election results. Although KDKA was called a commercial station, commercial indicated they were broadcasting to the public. Actual commercials wouldn't be a part of the station programming for several years. KDKA is one of a handful of U.S. stations to have a K as the first letter of its call sign, even though it's east of the Mississippi.
Using a K or a W for the first letter of radio call signs dates back to Morse code ship call signs from the early 1900s. All ships off the west coast of the United States were given a call sign starting with W, which makes sense because they were west. And ships off the Atlantic coast were given a sign starting with K, which makes no sense. During the International Radio Telephone Conference held in 1912, the U.S. was told to keep W and K for radio call signs. For some reason, and we couldn't find anyone who knows exactly why, the K and W designations got swapped for land-based stations. There's the theory it allowed for the distinction between land and water-based transmitters. Others believe it was a government clerical error.
At first, the east-west dividing line for K or W was the border between Texas and New Mexico. By 1923, it was moved further east to the Mississippi River. A few stations in the gap were licensed before the border move. Those stations retain the W call letters today, even though they are west of the Mississippi. Likewise, early eastern stations given a K set of call letters, like KDKA in Pittsburgh, still retain those call letters. There is one station, KTGG in Michigan, who got their call letters because someone at the FCC mistook Michigan for Missouri.
Close enough for government work. Okay, I think we get the idea. This speech is boring. As Art continues about the importance of radio, the camera scans the room. Bailey's checking out her fingernails. Johnny is inspecting the bottom of his shoe. Venus yawns as he settles in on the couch. Herb is leaning back with his elbow on his desk. He rests his head with his chin in his open hand. He's staring forward as we hear a voiceover. It's his voice, only with an accent.
The screen dissolves to Herb in what appears to be a military uniform, sitting at a table with candles. He's speaking on the phone in some kind of accent.
Forgive me, darling. I'm sorry for these constant interruptions. They cannot be avoided. I have my duties. See, I said I did not wish to discuss it any further.
He hands the phone receiver to the waiter. The camera backs up and we see Jennifer sitting at the table with him. She's dressed as though they're in some tropical climate. She's wearing a very revealing peach formal gown with thin spaghetti straps and a peach-colored flower tucked above her right ear.
Hey, now hold on a minute. The guy who brought Herb the phone? We were pretty sure it was stage manager Buzz Sapien, but not 100%. You remember Buzz was the guy who was chewing gum in the elevator in the episode I Do for Now, and he got some great laughs off of Hoyt Axton and Lonnie Anderson.
That was so funny.
He was great. Well, we wanted to confirm, so we reached out to associate producer Max Tosh. Max said, yes, that's Buzz.
Yay!
And he also pointed out the greatest detail. Herb says...
Gracias, Buzzy.
he's saying buzzy with his accent. I love that.
Boozy.
Gracias, Boozy.
Jennifer is gazing at Herb with great affection. So, you know, this is a dream.
Herb's dream.
Yes.
Oh, Franco.
There's been some rebel action today near Esteban, but it is of no great concern.
I wouldn't want to take you away from your responsibilities.
Herb's character in this vignette is named Franco. Franco is a good, non-specific South American dictator first name. But we also like how it's the Spanish counterpart to Frank, which is Mr. Bonner's real first name.
Oh, Franco.
Herb is tapping down two cigarettes, or Franco, as he is speaking. He puts them in his mouth at the same time, lighting them both. He offers one to Jennifer.
I don't smoke.
Franco puts the cigarettes out. They walk over to the edge of the balcony.
Okay, now a man lighting two cigarettes at once was the ultimate in cool following the hit 1942 Betty Davis movie, Now Voyager. In one of the final scenes, Paul Henreid opens a cigarette case and he pulls out two cigarettes. He lights both in his mouth and he hands one to Betty Davis. People went nuts over this move. Women were stopping Henreid in airports, asking him to light their cigarettes the same way. Although Henreid claims he thought up the move, the film's director called him a liar. The same trick appeared in the 1932 movie The Rich Are Always With Us, and it appeared in a D.W. Griffith film from 1917. Even though it may not have been original, this method for lighting two cigarettes at once has forever been associated with Henreid.
Jennifer comments on how beautiful it is here. There's a big full moon just to Franco's right, and the dark sky is full of many stars. Franco suggests they dine on his yacht tomorrow night. He tells her the lights from Lucero are beautiful at dusk. He's playing with Jennifer's hair and running his hand down her arm as he speaks.
And she's letting him.
Yes, she's not cringing or anything. Sporadically throughout this scene, we can hear small arms fire in the distance. Things don't seem stable in Franco's world.
Jennifer turns to walk back and sit at their table.
Oh, Your Highness, you are so kind, so giving, so strong. And I wouldn't want to cause you any more problems than you already have, but I think I might be very much in love with someone for the first time in my life.
And did you notice in Herb's world, he's royalty?
Yes, Your Highness. Franco has a similar problem about falling in love. Now, check Frank Bonner's timing on this line. He makes it funny by adding just the slightest pause.
It is possible that I, too, may be in love with someone. The Pope has again refused the divorce.
He says Ricardo called from Rome, saying the situation is impossible.
I understand, Your Highness. Sometimes religion can be so inconvenient.
Franco is standing behind Jennifer. He rubs her shoulders, leans down and kisses her on each ear as he tells her they have tonight and the night after. She tells him she has the memories of all their nights. She will hide them away under her pillow.
My darling.
Franco reaches for Jennifer's hand. As he pulls her hand towards him to kiss it, he knocks over a glass of wine and it spills on his white uniform.
Suddenly, we cut to Herb jumping up from his desk. We're back in the bullpen and Herb has just knocked his coffee cup into his lap. When Herb stands up, that's when we realize
it's time.
Herb Darling, fashion alert.
Herb is wearing a three-piece shades of blue suit with a plaid jacket, plaid vest, and plaid pants.
And we cannot state strongly enough how much plaid we're looking at here.
And I'm assuming he has his white shoes on. We don't see him, but no, I bet they're there.
Oh, man, is that a lot of plaid. Art's giving Herb a stern look.
Sorry, BK. Sorry, big guy. It's just that your speech, it just made me want to jump up.
Big guy. Art thanks Herb.
It's just that, well, radio, to me, I don't know. What can I say?
Art is smiling, so happy his speech has had such an effect on Herb. And he tells Mr. Carlson to go on.
Radio entered the 30s like a speeding locomotive. Suddenly there were big-time radio stars. These big-time radio stars went to Hollywood. became big-time movie stars.
The camera scans over to Jennifer, and we begin to hear her daydream. There is a piano playing Stardust by Hoagie Carmichael and Mitch Parrish. We fade in on Jennifer. She's wearing a long white satin gown, dripping with diamonds all over her earrings, a huge diamond necklace, diamond rings, and a diamond bracelet. She's lying on a round bed covered in white satin sheets and on a white fur throw. She also has a white feather boa around her shoulders. It's all poofy, foofy.
And you remember how we talked about how these are so much fun for the actors? This had to be a blast.
Had to be.
So the song we're hearing is a 1927 composition by Hoagie Carmichael called Stardust. Carmichael wrote it while he was still a student at Indiana University. He would record the instrumental version in 1928. Carmichael was hired by Mills Music as a composer. His Mills co-worker Mitchell Parrish added lyrics to the song. In 1940, Tommy Dorsey did a version of Stardust with Frank Sinatra on vocals.
So I dream in vain. In my heart it always will remain. My Stardust melody. The memory of love's refrain.
Artie Shaw released a version the same year, which sold more than a million copies. Stardust has been recorded more than 1,500 times, and it's considered part of the Great American Songbook. It was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1995 and added to the National Recording Registry in 2004.
Jennifer is speaking into a white and gold telephone receiver.
I'm sorry, please understand. I was out very late last night, and now I'm indisposed.
As the camera moves in on Jennifer, we see a hand holding a cigarette in the foreground.
If they bring a gift, of course, accept it, but then be a dear and shoo them away. That's right. I must go.
She hangs up the phone and looks to the camera. We now have the point of view of the man with the cigarette.
I knew you'd come.
Jennifer, my darling. I didn't want to disturb you, to burden you with my petty needs, but try as I might, there's no way I could stay away from you.
Jennifer smiles into the camera.
Sit down, Carrie. There's no one I'd rather lounge around the house with than you.
There's no credit for whoever was doing the impression, but that was supposed to be Cary Grant with the cigarette. Cary Grant was an English-American actor who worked from 1932 until 1966. He was born Archibald Alec Leach in 1904 in Bristol, England. He became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1942. He also changed his name legally to Cary Grant at the same time. Grant was known to be meticulous in his dress and deportment. He really did smoke, reportedly 2 packs a day until the 1950s, but he considered it a dirty habit. He was careful to never be photographed smoking. Although he was known for his matinee idol good looks, Grant could bring the funny. He starred in classic comedies like Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday. Grant made 77 movies in his career. He died in 1986 at the age of 82.
Jennifer lies back on the bed, striking a sexy pose. She begins to say something more. Then her eyes get wide with surprise. We cut to a reverse angle so we can see what Jennifer sees. Jennifer is looking into the face of Les Nessman. Which brings us to
the line of the episode.
I was wondering if you could pour something sticky all over me.
This is in her daydream. How come she's making him say that in her daydream?
But he delivers it so sincerely, looking at her right in the eyes. Oh, God.
So this definitely snaps Jennifer out of her daydream.
Yeah.
Suddenly, we're back in the bullpen. Jennifer is sitting there with her eyes wide as we hear Art continue to drone on.
Yeah, as Leo Tolstoy has said so well, so many times, art should educate as well as entertain, and so should radio.
Oh,
Oh, why not? Jennifer looks over at Les.
Tolstoy said that about radio?
Carlson explains Tolstoy said it about art. He added the part about radio.
That's interesting, because your name is Art.
And Herb is sucking up.
Leo Tolstoy was a Russian author who was born in 1828. He is best known for his two longest works, War and Peace and Anna Karenina. Both are commonly regarded as among the finest novels ever written. Tolstoy died in 1910 at the age of 82, and I have not read either one of those.
Neither have I.
Heard a lot about them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you hear all about them, and how long they are, usually, yes. is what you hear about them.
Carlson stares at Herb for a moment, then he continues.
As I was saying, in 1937, the CBS radio network sent Edward R. Murrow to cover the Second World War.
Oh, boy, he's my hero.
And by doing so, changed the face of radio forever. Who can forget the men, the machines, the invasions, the blitz?
Blah, the blah, blah.
The camera closes in on Les, who is leaned back in his chair, hands with fingers intertwined behind his head. He has a thoughtful look on his face. Suddenly we see Les in a somewhat military-looking helmet and overcoat. He's holding a microphone with the letters CBS on top. We discover he's giving a report during the German bombing of London. Although Les looks military, he would have been a civilian in the 1930s.
Now, we've mentioned Egbert Roscoe Murrow previously in the series. Murrow did broadcast from London starting in 1939, opening each report with his catchphrase,
"This is London."
He also developed another famous line by closing his casts, "Good night and good luck." Murrow assembled a group of reporters in Europe acclaimed for their intellect and descriptive powers. This group is still considered to be one of the finest news teams ever. It included Eric Severide, Howard K. Smith, Bill Downs, and Charles Shaw, among many others. They would be known as Murrow's Boys throughout the war.
And even though they called them Murrow's Boys, there actually was a woman in that group.
"This is London. On fire tonight as it has been for the last 10 days. But while it is a city aflame, it is also a city unvanquished. Hitler has certainly made a terrible mistake. For here there is renewed determination."
Les goes on to report that even through all the destruction and inhumanity, there has been witness to the iron will resolve of a people.
"That resolve is one flame that cannot be extinguished. This is Lester Nessman, high atop Westminster Abbey, saying good night to all America from this valiant isle."
As Les finishes his report, Bailey, also dressed in military-looking garb, comes running out, begging Les to get off the top of the building. It's too dangerous, and it's Westminster Abbey he's on top of.
"The bombs have stopped their pitter-patter thump for tonight."
"It's cold."
Les reaches up, and you think he's going to offer his coat to Bailey. Instead, he flips up his coat collar, puts his hands in his pockets, and continues to look out into the night.
Bailey hooks her arms through Les's, asking if he minds. He tells her he doesn't mind.
"World could use a little human closeness right about now."
Bailey puts her head on Les's shoulder.
"I guess I ought to be getting back to the hotel, have a few drinks with Walter and Eric, and then drop off into some dreamless abyss, forgetting that I haven't eaten since yesterday."
Bailey asks Les if she can drive him.
"Well, sure, Toots, you're my driver."
Toots.
Bailey walks over to the edge of the roof and looks out, asking Les if he knows what's funny. We hear As Time Goes By from Dooley Wilson begin playing. She talks about how she hates the war, but loves it, too, because it brought the two of them together.
"Yes, I guess that is funny, in a way."
We're guessing Les is name-checking Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide when he says Walter and Eric. Eric Severide most likely would have been on hand for a drink, but not Walter. Although he tried, Murrow was never able to get Walter Cronkite in as one of his European boys. He offered Cronkite the Moscow Bureau, where he would have taken over for Bill Downs. Cronkite initially accepted, but then he turned the post down in favor of a position with his current employer at the time, United Press.
As Time Goes By was written by Herman Hupfeld for the 1931 musical Everybody's Welcome. It became famous as the signature musical theme from the 1942 Humphrey Bogart movie, Casablanca. In the film, it was performed by singer and actor Dooley Wilson, who played Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Dooley was a drummer, a band leader, and a singer, but he was not a piano player. His piano accompaniment was played by Gene Plummer and dubbed.
Fun fact, although the quote, "Play it again, Sam," is attributed to Bogey in the movie, he never said the line. Actually, nobody ever said that line. Ilse said,
"Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by."
And Bogey said,
"You know what I want to hear?"
"No, I don't."
"You played it for her, you play it for me."
"Well, I don't think I can remember."
"If she can stand it, I can. Play it."
"Yes, boss."
As Time Goes By has been recognized by the American Film Institute as the second most important song to ever appear in an American film. It was beaten out for the top spot by Judy Garland's Somewhere Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz.
Bailey asks Les, "When this whole thing is over, where will the two of them be?" Les tells her, "Who knows, and who's to say it will ever really be over?"
"It's the Axis powers now, but after that, the Russian bear is a hungry one. Don't forget I said that."
Bailey asks him,
"What about us?"
"Us? You crazy kid. Don't you realize in this gone mad cockamamie world, the lives of two people like us don't amount to a hill of beans."
If you listen carefully, you can hear several words and phrases lifted from Casablanca in this scene.
"It doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world.
Even if I am the voice all the USA rushes home to hear every night."
Les tells Bailey if America does go to war in Europe, it will be because of what they heard him say.
Les mentions the Axis powers. The Axis powers were the Allied forces' boogeyman during World War II. The Axis was a loose military coalition comprised of Germany, Italy, and Japan. Originally called the Rome-Berlin Axis, the name was coined by Benito Mussolini after the October 1936 signing of a pact between Italy and Germany. Mussolini said all of Europe would rotate on the Rome-Berlin Axis. Japan was added in later. The Axis powers never formally worked together, and during much of the war, they were actually at odds with each other. Following their defeat in 1945, the Axis was dissolved.
The bear, typically a Eurasian brown bear, has been a symbol of Russia since the 16th century. Although Russia was a U.S. ally during World War II, they would become a rival superpower following the war. The rivalry would lead to more than 50 years of Cold War, nuclear proliferation, and here's where Les comes in, communist paranoia.
Oh, and as much as Les would like to think he's going to get the U.S. involved in World War II, it was the attack on Pearl Harbor that ultimately drew America into World War II.
But you're not going to convince Les of that.
No, no.
Bailey is playing with the strap that is hanging down from Les's helmet.
And me?
You're my driver.
Yes.
Don't forget, Toots. At least we'll always have Paris.
I've never been to Paris.
I know. What I mean is, Paris will always be there.
See.
Les says, "We'll always have Paris." This line really was said in Casablanca, and it's considered one of the most famous movie quotes ever uttered. Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart, says it to Ingrid Bergman as Ilsa in that incredible final scene.
"We'll always have Paris."
He's referring to their brief affair together in Paris prior to the start of World War II. Their time in Paris was cut short by Nazi Germany's invasion of France.
That would kind of throw
a damper on things, yeah.
Les tells Bailey that he will meet her at the car. Bailey salutes him and leaves the roof. Les takes his helmet off and puts one foot up on the edge of the roof.
"Wherever brave men are spending their lives for freedom, I'll be there. wherever internationally known journalists are gathered for a drink, I'll be there. Wherever bombs are exploding, I'll be there.
We hear the high whistle of a bomb falling close to Les. He looks up and leans back, watching it. Suddenly, we are in the bullpen and Les jerks up from almost falling over backwards. He looks over at Bailey, who is staring into space, her eyes not focused on anything. That was a great transition.
And I was impressed by that whole scene from a technical standpoint.
The light scanning
and the bombs and the... That was great.
The costuming, everything. It looked really good.
As we see a dazed-looking Bailey trying not to fall asleep, we can hear Art continuing to drone on in the background.
One of my most exciting personal memories of recent times is when President Ford visited our Queen City. I remember we sent a remote out to the airport.
Did President Ford really visit Cincinnati? The only Cincinnatian to ever hold the office of president was William Howard Taft. But a number of U.S. presidents have made a stop in the Queen City. Gerald Ford visited both as vice president in April of 1974, then again as president on July the 4th of 1975.
We transition to Bailey sitting up in bed. She has her hair in pigtails. Reading glasses are on as she writes in a notebook. She's wearing blue pajamas with some dark blue edging. The camera expands to show Johnny wearing matching blue pajamas and bringing Bailey a cup of something.
Here's your tea, darling.
Bailey takes the cup and sets it on the bedside table. Johnny's telling her he doesn't think this reception is going to go well tomorrow as he gets into bed beside Bailey.
I swear, I think the last tenants took half the silver with them. We've got 500 guests invited.
Bailey tells him not to worry about it. Johnny continues.
Don't worry about it. You know, I am doing my best to keep the social calendar together, and I just don't feel like you're giving me any help at all.
Bailey continues to write in her notebook, not responding to Johnny.
Are you even listening to me?
Bailey apologizes, saying she has a lot of things on her mind.
Johnny tells her he knows she does.
It's just that I feel so distant, so... left out.
Johnny puts a head on Bailey's shoulder. Just any head. Johnny puts his head on Bailey's shoulder. Bailey tells him she'll make it up to him and the kids this weekend.
Do you think it'd be okay if I brought some friends by the Rose Garden on Friday?
Johnny's kids. Can
Johnny's
you imagine?
Kids. You know they love classic rock. Bailey tells him, sure, she'll be at Camp David most of the day. Johnny tells her, thank you, and then tilts his head up, waiting for a kiss. Bailey looks at him.
What?
Thank you.
Johnny rolls over, turns out his lamp, and covers his head with a pillow because Bailey is practicing her speech she's been working on.
To our recently recognized friends in the Asian community. Good.
Bailey as president? So they finally gave us some clues as to what we are seeing here. Bailey is daydreaming about being the president of the United States, and Johnny is her first fella. But, you know, those pigtails don't look very presidential
no,
to me.
They really don't.
They look like a little girlish. The mention of Gerald Ford must have triggered it. This one seems labored and a little odd. Bailey is stressed and her marriage to Johnny doesn't seem all that happy. If you're going to daydream about being president, you'd think it would be the good stuff. Plus, this whole sequence is kind of boring.
Uh-huh.
It's no surprise for several of the syndication packages, including the MeTV airings from the early 2000s, Bailey's daydream was cut entirely from this episode. Good decision.
Yeah, didn't lose a whole lot. Suddenly, Bailey snaps her head up and looks over at Johnny, who's lying on the couch. Art continues.
And don't think running a station is easy. Far from it. Bringing a station together under a single banner of leadership is no easy task.
The camera comes to Andy, and we hear Speak Softly Love, also known as the love theme from The Godfather. The music was written by Nino Rota, who also did the score for the movie. Larry Cusick wrote the English lyrics. Andy's voice can be heard.
Tell me, Herb, your family well?
Without respect.
Yes, Andrew. Your children? The children are fine. And your wife? The wife is fine. They all send their respects.
That's nice.
The camera has turned to show Andy sitting in a black leather chair. His hair is slicked back and parted right down the middle. Wearing a dark blue suit with a maroon tie, a matching pocket square, and a dark pink carnation in the jacket lapel. He has his fingertips together, and you can see a large ring on his left ring finger. From his right side, Venus bends down, whispers something to Andy, then looks over at Herb.
Venus tells me that you have a problem. How is it I may help you?
Andy is, of course, playing the godfather of WKRP. The lighting, the music, and the style of this production all mimic the original 1972 film's famous wedding scene. The day of the Don's daughter's wedding, it was possible for any favor to be asked and granted, but the person receiving the favor would then be in the Don's debt. It's telling that all of our other daydream sequences so far have happened elsewhere. Andy only aspires to be respected around the station. If he could just get Herb a client and get Johnny to play the playlist, he'd be a happy man.
Herb is nervously biting his pinky fingernail as he speaks.
I need a favor, Andrew.
We see Andy's hand move in front of the camera, motioning Herb to continue.
I've been working on this account now for a month, and I've done everything I can do, but this guy just won't sign.
Well, perhaps I should speak with him.
If you could, Andrew, I'm sure he'd fall in line. I'd do anything to get this account.
Maybe the day will come when I will ask you to return the favor.
Herb tells Andrew, of course, thank you, and he stands to leave.
Before leaving, he turns to look at Don Andrew.
May I?
And he holds out his hand with the ring towards Herb. Herb bends to kiss the ring, keeping his eyes on Venus as he does. Herb takes Andy's hand, kisses the ring, but then he can't pull his hand away. Andy's holding on to it. Andy leans forward and he smiles as he puts his hand on the side of Herb's face. Herb smiles back, somewhat tentatively. Then suddenly, Andy slaps Herb. Herb slowly stands up, smiles, and walks out of the office, rubbing his cheek as he leaves.
He now owes a favor.
To the Don.
Jennifer comes into the office asking Andrew to forgive her for barging in.
Forgiving you is always a pleasure, Jennifer.
Jennifer sits in the chair that Herb just vacated, telling Andy she needs a favor. Andy tells Venus perhaps he could look into the matter they had discussed earlier that morning. Venus quietly says,
Fever.
And leaves. Andy leans forward and asks Jennifer how he can help her.
It's Herb.
He's causing you a problem.
Every day it's the same thing. Bad puns, stupid sexist come-ons, ridiculous clothes. It's boring.
Andy asked Jennifer what she would like him to do.
I would like you to make Herb get off the planet.
And the Don can do that. So Andrew tells Jennifer he'll speak with Herb.
I'm sure he'll be happy to do me a favor.
Jennifer thanks him.
Perhaps one day you can do me a favor in return.
Oh, that would be fun.
Jennifer leaves the room. We hear a voice from the hallway.
Hey, honey, keep walking like that, huh?
Johnny enters, followed closely by Venus.
Hey, Andy, how you doing?
Johnny, it's so nice of you to come.
Hey, I guess you know why you're here, huh?
Well, I think because Venus asked me to come.
Johnny not affording the proper level of respect. He takes Venus's tie out from under his jacket and he flips it up into his face, laughing.
Or a question of my being concerned for your welfare.
I wouldn't do that to Venus. Not a good choice. Johnny tells Andy he's okay as he sits down. Andy walks around behind him.
It's a question of, how should I say? I say, respect. You know, not just for me, but for the organization.
Andy pats Johnny's shoulder as he says this. Andy walks away, and Johnny starts to stand, only to be pushed back down in the chair by Venus.
Johnny. Hey, I got a problem here. I'm asking for your help.
Andy sits back down behind his desk. Johnny looks at Andy, smiling.
What problem? I mean, we're family, huh?
Andy tells him that's true.
But that shouldn't keep you from playing the playlist. You see, I'm asking you to play the top 10 hits.
Play the list.
Johnny tells Andy he'll play half the list. It's all he can do.
Andrew, you're not going to push me around.
Andy smiles. Johnny and Andy begin to laugh. Andy tells Johnny, thanks for coming, as he holds out both of his hands. Suddenly, Andy grabs Johnny on each side of his head and he kisses him on the forehead. Oh. It's the kiss of death.
Bum, bum.
Johnny hangs his head and starts to walk out of the room. He turns to Venus, grabbing him by the arm.
Get me out of this, Venus. Talk to him, huh?
Venus is no help. He pulls his arm away from Johnny, and Johnny leaves the room. Andy looks at Venus and nods to him.
I'll take care of it.
Andy tells him, do it tonight.
When I'm at the speech.
Instead of at the christening, he'll be at the speech.
We again transition to the bullpen, where Andy is sitting with a smirk on his face. Carlson is still talking as Andy turns to look at Venus.
There will never again be giants like Fred Allen, George, and Gracie Burns.
Carlson's voice fades, and we hear an announcer making an introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, Flytrap Productions presents America's favorite funny man, Venus Flytrap!
We see gold curtains opening, and Venus steps out, wearing a tuxedo with a silver chain link belt. Venus is smiling and waving as a hand from off to the side gives him a microphone.
This set looks a lot like Johnny Carson's stage, and I thought it was at first, but we quickly realize Venus is in Vegas doing his act.
Even the background music that's playing that.
It had that feel to it, that Carson feel. This is kind of an odd one. We've never had an inkling about Venus really wanting to do stand-up. If anything, Venus would probably be better suited as a self-help guru or a motivational speaker. It is interesting to note, Tim Reed is the only member of the cast who truly did stand-up. He and Tom Dreesen performed as Tim and Tom in the late 60s and early 70s. Howard Hessman was an improv performer, but improv is quite a bit different than stand-up.
Venus tells everyone he's touched. They all came to see him. He begins pointing down into the audience, saying hello to specific people.
I love you. Hey, Frankie, Sammy, Wayne, thank you for the bell, baby.
And he's got the smarm thing down. It's so good.
Yes, it's a definite Sammy Davis vibe about him.
You are more than kind. I hope you don't mind if I do this.
Thank you. You're beautiful. Thank you.
He launches into his act, which really doesn't contain any real jokes.
Hey, how many of you folks out there are married? Come on. Do I have to say any more? Thank you.
Hey, you're not funny.
What was that?
You stink!
That's my cologne, OD motorcycle.
Where did they get this guy?
Thanks for caring, sir. They got me from heaven. Hey, what about that darn solar system, huh?
Get off the earth!
Isn't it sad when cousins marry?
Huh? That's a Mark Mull joke!
Giving credit where credit is due, it's hard to hear, but Johnny says that's a Martin Mull joke. Chicago-born comedian, author, composer, actor, and host of Fernwood Tonight, Martin Mull, is credited with writing the Cousins Marry comeback.
And it's still sad when cousins marry.
I guess you're proof of that.
So did I tell you how to do your job?
Probably because you don't know anything about that either. Fever! Amen! That's fever! What are you doing here?
We come back to the bullpen, and Venus is giving Johnny a dirty look.
Now, let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads.
Venus is wearing a long-sleeved purple satin shirt that is unbuttoned to reveal two gold chain necklaces. He has a red sash tied around his waist with dark pants and black ankle boots. Now, we're pretty sure Venus was doing his shout-outs to Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Wayne Newton. Frank and Sammy were well-known around Vegas as Rat Packers. Wayne Newton was never a Rat Pack member, but he has always been Mr. Vegas. Although he had the stand-up chops, Tim Reed's first appearance on The Tonight Show wouldn't be until 1985.
And he didn't do stand-up. He was just a guest. So Johnny is staring into space as Art drones on.
In the area of rock and roll, that field is dominated by the groups and individual stars whose songs speak for entire generations.
The screen fades to the greatest scene. Jennifer is the limo driver to a rock and roll star.
Oh, and she's all in white again.
Oh, yeah.
Skin with the tight suit with silver knee-high boots.
Little limo hat on. She hops out of the driver's seat and she rushes to open the back door of the limo to reveal Johnny in all his rock star glory. You barely recognize Andy. He's Johnny's sleazy manager.
Yes, I didn't until I heard him talk.
Yeah, he yells Johnny 6 hours late and there's smoke billowing out of the back seat of the limo.
Johnny gets out of the back seat telling his manager he had some personal business to take care of. Johnny has Rod Stewart-like hair. He's wearing tight, shiny spandex blue pants and a leather jacket, unzipped. His chest is bare except for a large silver cross on a chain. He's also wearing a spiked dog collar as a like a choker. People are crowding around him and they want his autograph and they're trying to just touch him.
This had to be the most fun shooting this thing. Every member of the cast is crowded around Johnny.
How fun.
We got Herb the groupie in tight, shiny gold pants and sunglasses. He's telling Johnny they all love him. Suddenly, Herb goes down. He falls down and he's getting trampled by Johnny and maybe Bailey. She steps up beside Johnny.
So was this planned or was that an accident?
I don't know.
They decided to keep it in. It looked great.
It looked very, very natural, very realistic. Yeah. I think he just tripped and fell and they walked right over him.
The crowd's getting crazy.
So Johnny puts his arm around Bailey. He's dragging her along with him as he walks. Les is close behind, but Les is still in his bow tie.
Yeah, he's just Les.
Yeah.
Venus approaches Johnny. He's wearing an all-white suit, and his long hair is in tiny braids with beads all around his head. Andy asks who Venus is.
This is my Jamaican daughter.
I love you! I love you!
The group continues to walk into a backstage-looking area, and we hear an announcer.
He's here! The star of our show!
See the credentials on that doctor. So the announcement makes Johnny stop in his tracks. Transitioning back to the bullpen, Art has finished his speech and the staff are all on their feet applauding. Johnny is scrambling, trying to get up from the couch. Everyone tells Art how good his speech was as they all file out of the bullpen.
Spellbinding, big guy.
You really think so?
Fascinating.
Oh, Mr. Carlson, I hung on every word.
I don't know when I've heard a more interesting talk.
Yeah, really, the Gettysburg Address.
The radio, it's a guaranteed chiller.
Andy smiles at Mr. Carlson and putting his arms out to the side, he says,
huh?
Mr. Carlson is thrilled and tells Andy it was a great idea to practice his speech in front of everyone. He tells Andy he's feeling much more confident about the night.
She said, boy, like they were mesmerized. That's like the part about FM radio.
Who? Oh, see, that was my favorite part.
That cute little comment I made about Marconi.
Who was that?
Marconi.
Marconi. Oh, yeah, that was my favorite part.
Yeah, I should talk more often with
you. Absolutely.
Oh. Frankly, Andy, I think I stunned him.
Yeah, I think you did.
They both walk out of the bullpen.
Art went roots when he mentioned Marconi. Born in 1874, Guglielmo Giovanni Maria Marconi.
Now that's a name.
That is a name. Is credited with inventing radio. He was really trying to invent wireless telegraphy, a system for telegraph operators to communicate without wires. By the time Marconi got involved with solving this problem, researchers had been working on it for 50 years with little success. Marconi's breakthrough came in 1894 when he was able to push a button on one side of a room that rang a bell on the other side of the room with no wired connection.
Wow. That was a big deal.
That was a big deal. His contribution to the invention of radio was recognized in 1909 when he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics. Marconi died in 1937 at the age of 63. That's going to do it for Daydreams. Man, what a ton of fun that
I
was.
I love Johnny's scene.
Yeah, Johnny's scene, Herb's scene, just
so
some great stuff in
there.
Gracias, Buzzy.
All right, so what is up for next week, Donna?
Next week will be Frog Story. Herb accidentally sprays his daughter's pet frog with pink spray paint. He brings the frog to the station, hoping someone will know how to fix this problem before his daughter, Bunny, finds out. The frog doesn't look well.
This is one I've been looking forward to for a long time now. I love frog story. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. Find us on social media. You can follow our Facebook page at WKRPcast. And for a whole bunch more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us, WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye, y'all.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP Cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!